I'm Georgie Crawford. You're listening to the Good Glow podcast. Throughout my treatment for breast cancer, I've realised the importance of self-care. Whether it's a trip to the gym, a checkup with your GP, or even a five-minute meditation, the time has come for us to put ourselves higher on our own to-do list. I'll speak to people who remind us to take better care of ourselves, and what better way to take care of ourselves than to understand more about our bodies. This series, I've teamed up with Fitbit. Fitbit allows you to get to know yourself better and understand your health with insights that are unique to you. As I always say, knowledge is power, and Fitbit provides data about your health and well-being to help empower and support you in leading a balanced and healthy lifestyle. I'm so happy to have Fitbit on board, as my Fitbit helps keep me focused and on track with my goals and training. Being partnered with Fitbit is inspiring, as they're encouraging everyone to make positive changes, and I hope this podcast does too. This week on the Good Glow podcast, I talk to Kieran Byrne. Kieran was diagnosed with leukemia the day after returning home from honeymoon earlier this year. His wife, Denise Kenny, has been sharing snippets of their journey on her Instagram page, and now thousands of people check in every day for updates. Kieran is one of the most inspiring people I've ever spoken to. Our interview went on for well over an hour, which is why, for the first time, I've decided to split this episode into two parts. Kieran's attitude will blow you away. He credits human connection, support, positive thinking, and music for where he is today. I really hope you get as much out of these two episodes as I did. Kieran, thank you so much for being here today. I've followed your journey for so long on Instagram, and it's just such a pleasure to sit down with yourself and Denise this morning. So thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me, George. It's great to be here.
You're looking amazing. You look great. You're in great spirits, as always. That's one thing I noticed about you, is that you always had the smile. You were always dancing. And Denise shared so many gorgeous videos of you, and I feel like we all got to know you, and it's just great to see you in person and looking so well.
Yeah, I wasn't aware of half those videos going up online, but yeah, no, it's I've always kind of been a positive person, and I do feel great at the moment, and I'm not going to deny that I feel great. So yeah, it's all going really well, and yeah, great to get to this point to be talking to you on this lovely, fine, sunny morning.
I know, it's amazing. Tell me a little bit about your life before, I suppose, that day came when it changed forever.
Yeah. So I guess in terms of my life, I don't know where to start. You know, I'll probably just jump to, you know, beyond the wonder years of I grew up and, you know, those years in Glasnevin. But really, I guess in my adult life, if you want to call it that, one of the things that this focuses on, I guess, that I've always been self-employed. I graduated from DCU, but since the age of 21, I'm now 40, although you wouldn't think it. I've been self-employed as a software developer, and I've had lots of different businesses, and some have worked better than others. I've had one or two unique businesses. Funky Christmas Jumpers was one that people might know, with my pal Fabio and Donal. But, you know, I come from a family of seven. I'm very, very close with all of them, very close. And my father passed away when I was 12. So it's about 28 years ago now, this year. And then, of course, I'm married to Denise, my beautiful wife, who I met 10 years ago. Denise might say 9 years ago. I don't know. I lose track. But we got married last year in May. So, you know, I'd always been, you know, very heavily focused on work, and I enjoy my work immensely, building software products for people. And business has been going very well, ups and downs throughout the years, and the Celtic Tiger brought its own stresses and the recession and so on. But ultimately, I've been doing, you know, my own thing and doing quite well at it. But I guess, you know, we got married in May last year, And that was the best day of my life, without a shadow of a doubt, and the best weekend, actually. But I think leading into that, naturally, it was quite stressful. More stressful for Denise probably than for me. But, you know, it's funny how my focus was very much on work and boxing off projects and clients in the lead into that, and getting things over the line. August, though, was kind of funny because I remember I was, and this is really weird, but I remember I was in the shower and I noticed my hair kind of falling out a little bit. And if you can see me, I don't have much hair at the moment, but I always had a big mop of hair. It was always kind of, you know, something that I couldn't stop my hair growing. And it kind of just came out a bit weird. And I remember saying to Denise, I think my body's changing. And it was strange because I wasn't going bald, like pattern baldness, you kind of know. But I went to my GP and he did some tests and you know, blood tests and standard. And he said, yeah, you're fine. You seem to be a bit stressed. And, you know, I kind of always carried stress as an entrepreneur. You nearly carried it as a badge of honor, although I did at the time, which is completely wrong, of course, in hindsight. But it started with that in my mind. But what happened then was that I got accepted onto a startup program for another business that I was launching, which was fantastic, but more work. And that kind of happened around September, October, and I picked up a kidney infection, which I never got. It took a couple of weeks to shift, of course, for antibiotics. But I was saying, look, you know, this isn't a big deal. I'll carry on through. This startup program will be finished by Christmas. So I was doing that. I was juggling my other consultancy, if you want to call it that, software business. But, you know, the stress was kind of building. And what happens is you get busier. And so the Astro football I was playing with my mates was gone by the wayside. The gym was gone by the wayside. The eating regularly was being replaced by fast food. And I was going, look, it's coming into silly season, Christmas time anyway. I woke up one morning, I pulled my back really bad. I got out of the bed and just collapsed to the ground. I think that was October, and that was unusual for me. I'd only after getting over that kidney infection like a couple of days before. And I just felt banjaxed, but, you know, I kept going because that's what you do. This is odd, this will pass. And so December came, and I picked up a bug, like a winter bug, coughing and sniffling, but I couldn't shake it. And so I went back to the GP again, more prescriptions, antibiotics, which, of course, I thought, well, this is viral. Why is he giving me antibiotics? The usual, but I'll take them anyway. A small dose of steroids. You know, but I looked terrible. And, you know, everyone who saw me over Christmas said, you look terrible. And I stopped going to like the Christmas mad nights out, which was kind of unusual for me.
And why was that? Just because you were too tired?
I just didn't really have the enthusiasm for them. And I love Christmas. I mean, I love putting the jumpers on and going out with the pals and out with Denise. And like, I live for those nights. Like, they're great fun. But, you know, I was working a lot and I was stressed and I felt fatigued. But fatigue is funny because there is a difference between being tired and fatigued. I'd walk to the shop and I just kind of would feel a bit like I could sit down. Where, I mean, you're a fit 40-year-old, you should be running to the shop, by the way, is not 10 miles away, it's 10 minutes away. And I just really didn't feel myself. I had this weird metallic-y taste in my mouth. My skin complexion had gone kind of this whitey, waxy colour, a bit like Jon Snow, you know, when he's just coming back. And I didn't feel quite myself, but I was that busy working. And I now notice I'm a big fan of trends. And I guess the big thing is I was trending down from a health point of view. Work was great. I was bringing in more work. And I thought this, you know, get through to Christmas. We had booked in a fabulous honeymoon for just after Christmas. And so I thought, you know, I'll get to Christmas and I'll be fine. But Christmas Day, it was upsetting because all my family, who I'm very close with, they were all saying it to me very bluntly, as family do. And, you know,
But isn't that great that they were flagging that?
Yeah, people were really saying it to me. You look terrible. And no one had ever really said it to me before. But, you know, one thing actually that struck me, I was on business and I was in a hotel and I stood on the scales just as you do in the bathroom. I hadn't stood in them in a while and I hadn't really changed anything. And my weight had dropped like 4 kilos. And no one had noticed. I had noticed. But I remember looking up before and saying, if your weight is plunges without any substance behind that, that's something that you should maybe keep an eye on. Mm. And like, I hadn't changed my diet. In fact, I thought it had gone up because I hadn't really been exercising. And so that was peculiar.
So did you have this kind of this little niggle kind of in your head?
I had a feeling that there was something underlying here, but I felt that it wasn't serious. I felt that over the years I've suffered from a B12 deficiency, and I get a B12 injections. I was getting them from time to time. People might take supplements, and they really boosted me over the years. I had low B12 times when my bloods come back, and that, I thought it was something like that, because what happens is you get a B12 supplement and your energy levels go back up. And so I thought it might have been that, but I really didn't, I didn't dwell on it too much because I was that busy working.
You're just kind of in survival mode. You're like, keep survival. Going. I've got the honeymoon coming. I'll relax then.
I'm 100% in survival mode. And so we got through Christmas. My mother says, she's funny. She said, I knew you weren't well when you didn't eat all your Christmas dinner, because you never miss you always eat your Christmas dinner. And she's right. It's hands down like my favorite meal of the year, you know. And so I didn't quite finish it, you know. That extra croquette was left on the
plate. Mammies always know, don't they?
They do. They have a really good instinctive knowledge of their sons and daughters. But we went on honeymoon in start of January, and honeymoon was fantastic. We went to Cape Town and we did the safari. I wasn't feeling fully 100% on safari, but when we went then to the Maldives, I felt great. But like the Maldives, you can't feel bad. Like, mm-hmm. We were lying there in a lounge with the sun coming down, and you're not exerting yourself. And, you know, the only thing I'll say is that I remember one morning I said to Denise, right, I'm going to start at my 2019 health buzz, you know. And I put on, it was like a Nike ad. I put on the Nike gear. I had my iPhone in. I put on Rocky, you know. And it's true. And I went out and I said, I'm gonna go jogging, you know. And the music kicks off. It's like, duh, 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 duh. And I went running. I didn't even get beyond the first couple of bars. Like, and I was like, oh my God, have I become that unfit over the last couple of weeks? And so I walked the rest of the island instead of running it. But I thought tomorrow I'd do a little bit more. But I still felt kind of okay. Like, I didn't feel like I was going to faint. I just felt lazy, you know. And then we had a night where, like, I love 80s music. I'm a sucker for 80s music. And there was a great 80s band playing. And I was up dancing with them all. I said, feck this, I'm getting up. And so I was up dancing. But I was just out of breath. And they were saying, well, you've hit 40. And in hindsight, I was like, no, actually, you were seriously unwell. So so we came back and I made a promise to myself. I said, look, if we're coming back and I still feel unwell, I had gotten into the habit of getting a yearly checkup anyway. Mm. But I said, I'm going to get a checkup sooner than I usually would. And so we came back, and on the plane, I just had a sense that I'm still not 100%. I'm about 80%. So I went to Charter Medical 2 days later. I said to Denise, look, I'm going to go and get a checkup. Denise kind of went, look, I think mostly you're okay, but if that's put your mind at ease. And so I went, got the checkup. They were like, yeah, everything's fine, you know. We took my bloods, but I did this at the end. Then the consultant said to me, Kieran, or the doctor said to me, Kieran, why are you here? And when I started describing why I was there and how I was feeling, she did seem a little bit more concerned, to be fair, because they do their standard tests at first, you know, bloods and things. And she's like, right, okay, that's interesting, get back up on the bed there. And I was like, oh, okay, right. And she kind of took more of an interest. And but the bloods went off to the laboratory and they said, look, we'll be back in touch in 2 weeks, as you'd expect. I went home, was having a cup of tea, and literally 2 hours later, I got a phone call from the Mater Hospital to say, Kieran, is this Kieran Byrne? Yes. Is this the Mater Hospital? I said, the Mater Hospital? Like, what are you calling me? They're like, we've received your bloods. You need to come in straight away. Come into A&E, ask for Dr. X. Not Dr. X, isn't it? ask for the doctor, and you know, straight away. So I went into the matter with Denise.
Were you kind of panicky?
I was. Yeah. I knew that something was up because those phone calls, they don't ring you for the fun of it. And so going in, you know, I started getting a bit emotional and upset because, to be honest with you, it had brought back kind of memories of my father when he was ill and he had cancer like when I was 12. And I remember that moment. And so, I didn't want to ring our alert anyone. So Denise just spun in the car, but we went in to A&E. I rang Charter on the way in and she said, look, Ciarán, this doesn't sound great, to be honest with you. This sounds serious, so you have to go in. And so I went in, and within like, you know, half an hour, we were called into a private room, essentially, just off A&E. And consultant came in, who turned out to be my consultant on the journey in the matter. And, you know, I was kind of making light, oh, what am I doing in here? But to be fair to him, he just cut straight to the chase and said, look, Ciarán, I'm afraid to say this is very serious. You have leukemia.
Oh,
and there was no mincing of words. There was no lead up. It was that they were the words that came out of his mouth. And that's where it all began.
It's that... I feel like when I was driving to the hospital to be told I had cancer, like there's nothing you can do to get away from the situation you're in. Like you have to go, you have to face it. And it's at least I had found a lump, so I kind of had prepared myself. But I think for you, like you must have been just in complete shock.
Well, yeah, because I said to him, do you mind if I go home and digest this, my family? And I said, I'll come back tomorrow type thing, thinking like, you know, he said, oh, you're not going anywhere. He said, you know, Ciarán, this is a life termination event in the next few weeks if we don't get this now. So he said, your chemotherapy starts now. I was like, so from the point of me going in there, I didn't leave hospital for 30 odd days. So there was no going home to get your bag of clothes and, you know, prepare for it, like you're started, you know. So I went from having a cup of tea 2 hours later to having a 30-day stint in the matter ahead of me, you know. And that was just, it was exactly like you're on the top of one of those kamikaze slides, you know, that goes straight down and it just kick you straight off the top. And that was it, you know.
And did you ring your family or did Denise?
So what happened next was that I just exploded into emotion and tears, and Denise comforted me, and then I rang my family, and luckily they're all kind of in Glasnevin, and they arrived in an instant, you know. And of course we reached out to Denise's family and some of her brothers arrived and the likes, but my own family were just there, you know, like, and it was so upsetting for me at the time, you know. And I don't really want to focus too much on the emotion of that occasion, because it is what you expect it to be. It's upsetting as hell.
Yeah,
you know, you hug and you cuddle and you know the tears flow. But at that very moment, that strength just begins and the positivity begins, and people just grab you and lift you, and you realize that nobody's going to let you drown in your emotion. And you know, it just starts, and you know, that's an incredible thing, you know, is that people's propensity to help each other and reach out, be that your brothers and sisters, Denise, you know, friends, family, just at that moment, it just let's get this guy better, and the medical team and the consultant, and you know, it kind of just moved to that. So, you know, I remember the emotion well, but look, there's no point in hanging on to that part of it. You know, it kind of is what it is. And yeah.
And that's the moment your life changes forever, when that switch goes in your brain and you're like, there is no other option for me. I will survive this. I will find my way. I, you know, with the help of your family, you just kind of feel like you're being carried, or like there's this army standing behind you.
Yeah. So like, the first, you know, one of the reasons why I'm always, why I'm keen to talk is that one of the first decisions I made, which was probably the best decision I made, was to be very, very open about it, and was to reach out to anybody I knew and tell them. Mm. All my friends, extended family. If the milkman had been going by, I would have told them. Because I recognised that this was something that not only did I need the support, but it would impact on everyone else too, that I wasn't the only one who was going to go through this journey. My family and Denise were going to go through it with me, and my friends and people, and everyone was going to hurt and everyone was going to feel this pain. But I felt being open and honest about it. I was diagnosed with AML, acute myeloid leukemia. It's a very fast moving. It comes on quickly and it's a fast moving. But if you catch it like anything else, it's treatable and ultimately curable. And so I wanted to kind of have that stigma addressed straight away, because we think of cancer as, you know, something very serious, which it is, of course. But the truth is that cancer is now moving into a domain where it can be treated like an illness, where it's treatable in a lot of cases. Of course, not every case, but in a lot of cases. And so to break down that stigma, because, you know, I went back to when my father had cancer at a time when it wasn't as treatable. And I was aware of the fact that I might be labelled like that in my own family. And I want to just be upfront and say, look, I have this. There's a plan that's been put in place here. Let's all be positive about this. And by doing that, everyone just, the positivity just, the dam just opened. And the positivity just flowed back down towards me. And it was just an incredible outpouring. And, you know, it was huge. And I think if I had have held that back and held that in and not made that decision at that point in time, and let me be clear, it was very uncomfortable for me to do that. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, I'm a guy, and in the past, like, I found it difficult to cry at my wedding, to be emotional. I'd always bottled in my emotion. And I think that was one of the reasons why I kind of had built up the stress, because in the past I found it difficult to cry, you know, and to be upfront about my emotions. And so I think that to be at that moment in time so open with everybody, even talking to you now, like, what I've learned is that you don't lose. It makes so much sense now, but at the time I didn't think about it that way. But you never lose being open with people and saying, I need help. Those words, you will never lose by saying that to someone, I need help, you know. And it started with that.
It's such an important message, and I did that as well. I was always really like, oh, I can do it, and, you know, you've got so much on your plate, but you're like, no, I'm fine. And then, yeah, it's about like kind of surrendering and accepting help, and then it transforms everything, I think.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about your treatment. Like, did you feel, you obviously went into action mode, did you feel like you were in safe hands, and were you like, you obviously felt very confident in your doctors and your team? And
so, like, I didn't have a clue about any of what I was about to go through. You know, as I sometimes say, it's kind of morbid humor. You know, it's my first time having, you know, leukemia and a transplant. I know that may sound strange, but like, I didn't know.
Did you Google it? Or did
No, I didn't go near the web.
Yeah, me neither.
Near the web. Like, you just can't. Mm. Because the web is always wrong.
Yeah.
It's always wrong. I was coming into this, I just might add, I was at times a terrible hypochondriac, and I did suffer from, and at times I probably still do suffer from anxiety. Mm. We all do, you know. And so, you know, I'd get acid reflux. I'd be online Googling that, you know, and acid reflux is, you need to get this investigated. And God, the amount of times I had myself written off, like, yeah, it's hilarious. And it always passes, like an hour later, you're fine. You know, Sunday night fear is the worst.
Absolutely.
The worst, you know. You know, and I've been that guy who's Googled, can you die from a hangover, you know. Absolutely, you know. And I won't be happy until I find that you can somewhere. But you know, it's funny because all those things, all those worries I had, all those concerns, I amounted to nothing. And they were never an issue, you know. And it's funny now, because I see people and I'm like, look, you know, you're absolutely fine. When you just know that it passes. But you know, so in that moment, I knew nothing. I took the decision that I wasn't going to really develop an interest in chemotherapy, let's put it that way. I didn't know the names of the drugs. I didn't ask the names of the drugs. I didn't know they gave the information on it. I chose to just take the medicine. I said, I can't control. You know what? I said, I can't control this part. So I'm going to put my trust in the medical team. And let me say, the medical team were excellent, amazing. I got treated in a Mater public hospital. There's no private care for this side of things. At least the best care was public, because you've multidisciplinary, interdisciplinary teams around you in case things do go wrong in a public, whereas in private, it may not, in this instance, have been the best. But I was in the Mater public on a lovely ward, St. Vincent's, and treated by an amazing team. And so I had complete faith and confidence in that side. I didn't need to know what they were giving me. I knew that they knew that this was the course of treatment for me. And it's very much protocol driven. Two rounds of induction chemotherapy to begin with. And then at that point, it's a decision on kind of whether you go for transplant or more chemotherapy. But staying on the early part of this, I didn't Google anything. I just took the medicine. And you know, that was the part that I couldn't control. They were brilliant, you know.
How was Denise around this time? Obviously, she's your number one fan, she told me yesterday. You can just, obviously, it's so obvious how in love you are. But was it tough for you to see her suffer?
Oh, you know, that's the toughest. That's one of the toughest things, I think, in this, is to see those around you suffer. You know, and like, it's the first year of your marriage, you know, you've just come off your honeymoon, you want to give your, now Denise is very independent anyway, but you want to give your wife everything in the sense of good memories and, you know, a good foundation to build our lives together. And to see Denise, like, I would know Denise was an absolute rock, and is an absolute rock, and I know that Denise would come up and, you know, she stayed with me, and every waking hour of the day she was there and questioning and getting information, to the point where I think the nurses felt that she was one of the staff and she was only short of getting a uniform. Many years to train, mind you, but you know, it's important to point that out. You can't just be a nurse walking in. But I would also note that Denise would go home, and when the door closed in the house, that she'd cry and she'd be frightened, and all my family would, and they'd shield me from elements of that. And that was tough for me to think about too much. But like, I'll be honest with you, I'd like to paint a picture, not like to, but us Irish have a way sometimes maybe painting a picture that was a tough time, but we had a great laugh. Like, I wouldn't lie, but like, you know, there was, like, we saw humour and as the Irish in weird things. And, you know, we did have a lot of laughter, and there was always positivity in the room, you know. And we settled into watching nice shows on TV. The things I could control, I did control. So the PlayStation arrived, Now TV, Apple TV, a lovely bedside lamp to get rid of those clinical white lights.
Oh, that's a great tip.
That is. I'm surprised the amount of people who don't know that. Like, the nurses come in and say, that's a great tip. Like, those clinical lights are horrible.
Yeah.
Lovely bedside lamp. It softens the mood. It's like a lovely apartment, you know.
Because I saw that video of you guys, like, it was like a silent disco. In the room.
Yeah.
Like, obviously, you're a funny guy. You're probably used to being like the life and soul of the party. Was it really important for you not to let this take your humor?
Yeah, like someone said to me, and they're so right. They're like, don't let this define you. And, you know, I had a pal who was going through cancer treatment at that moment in time, and he was going through chemo, and he popped in and he said, look, Karen, I see some people, they sit in that chair all day. They're like, per me. And don't get me wrong, there were days when I was ill that you have to sit in that chair and you have to be unwell. But then, like, I remind myself, and I'd say to my family, look, I've got leukemia, but I feel great. I came off the Maldives. I actually feel good, you know, like I feel myself. You know, and so I'd get up out of bed in the morning, I'd have a shower, I'd get in, you know, I'd put on some U2 uplifting music or, you know, something up with some dance music, and Denise be in the room and, you know, pottering about, and we'd get up and, you know, you'd get about your day, and you treated it like, I was like, look, I'm going to be in here for 30 days. I might as well enjoy it as much as I can, be comfortable with it. And I'd be yapping away to the nurses when they come in or to the care assistants, and you'd be talking about life. You'd see the rugby, you'd see this, and the consultant be in, and you'd have an IV line going into your arm with whatever medicine's going in, and it was chemotherapy or whatever. And you just wouldn't even think about it. You'd just be chatting and just like I said, not letting it define you. Just saying, look, I'm just sitting here in this room. It's funny because we took in the odd student into our house, you know, to help the mortgage. And sometimes they don't come out of the room for a month. And at times I'd remind myself, I'm like, I'm just like one of those students. I'm like, they don't leave their room for a month.
Yeah, and they're fine.
And they're fine, you know. And so we'd sit there and we would just, there was a lot of laughter, a lot of positivity. And, you know, and that was a down as well to Denise and to what people were bringing to the table, you know, and friends coming in. I was kind of filtering one or two so that the guys who were more high energy, they'll all be asking who they were, but the high energy people who brought laughter would kind of be more readily admitted to the club than others.
You don't need people coming in and bawling, crying. But you know,
some people just don't handle it maybe differently. Yeah, and they come in and they treat you like you a cancer patient, and I certainly didn't feel like that at the time. And so, yeah.
See, you said that did you feel better at this point than you, like, during your chemo than you did before December?
Yeah. The chemo, you go through different phases. So you get the initial 10 days of chemotherapy, and it's half an hour twice a day. And then there's different cocktails of chemotherapy you're getting kind of over those 10 days. And during that phase, you're feeling fine. And then you go into what's called a neutropenic phase, where essentially your blood count goes down to zero as such. And a component of your blood called the neutrophils are zero. And that's the component that protects you from infection. And so that's why you need to stay in hospital for a prolonged period of time, because it takes days to weeks for that to come back up. And so if you were out, you could get exposed to serious infections. And if you didn't get treated in time, you could pass away. It's that straightforward.
Right.
And so, you know, I think that at various different times, I guess the point I'm making is that you might feel unwell more so than others. But overall, I did feel kind of well. In the neutropenic phase, I got at one stage an infection in the hospital. And I was frightened because it was my first time getting an infection.
Mm.
And they knew that an infection would ultimately arrive. You know, it tends to, it's like as soon as that wall is down, your body in most time will attack you. There was something bubbling there, you know. And so so it did. And I was frightened because, you know, I was lying there going, geez, what's going on? But I got treated with a course of antibiotics, and ultimately you come back to yourself. But it's just strange because I still didn't feel that I had anything wrong with me. I still felt kind of okay. I felt, you know, this is just illness. I'm in hospital, but I felt good.
It's amazing what your body can like handle, isn't it?
It's incredible. It's incredible. I mean, you know, in total, I've taken about, you know, if we were to run the count, probably 60 bags of chemo, a stem cell transplant, all sorts of medication, you know, and some you take better than others, of course. I don't want this to be like everything was rosy, but your body can take a huge amount. It's up to you to back that up with your mindset, because, you know, we tend to view our mind and our body as two separate things. And it's funny because in Eastern medicine, they don't. But Western medicine is all, the pill is the cure. But actually, it's not. Like, it's like, you know, if you're feeling anxious, your tummy starts feeling off.
Mm.
And, you know, you might need to go to the loo, or you might need, you know, you start feeling a little bit unwell. Like, it's all connected. And so if you reverse that and say, well, if I'm feeling positive, you know, my body's equally going to start feeling well. And so, and that positive reinforcement, when I looked back at my text messages recently from the day I was diagnosed, and all the messages I got, I mean, my reply to each and every one of them was, I feel really good. I feel really strong. I'm going to beat this. I feel really good. I feel positive. I'm feeling strong. I actually don't feel sick. I feel fine. That positive reinforcement just kept kicking in and kept kicking in. And it gets to the stage where, like, you can nearly, I can nearly feel the atoms in my body, as crazy as that may sound, channeling this internal positive medicine throughout my body, like, you know, and just refusing, like, you actually can, I wouldn't go so far as maybe because I don't have the science behind it, and I accept medicine has a part in society, and that's really important to recognize that, but just as much as my mother said to me, and she was spot on, when Christmas time, when she saw me, she said, Kieran, if you keep working this hard, you're going to make yourself sick. And I believe that, and we'll never know what caused my leukemia, but I believe that stress was a big component of that for me. And people talk about nutrition and diet and alcohol and all these other substance abuses and other different things might cause for other people. I believe for me, stress was a big component. And the hard part, I probably did make myself sick, but equally I can make myself better, to complement the medicine. And so that type of positive reinforcement come from me. You add into that, like, Instagram just exploded. Mm. And you've 1,000 messages come from people on Instagram who you've never met saying, you're doing amazing, you're doing fantastic, we're all behind you, God, you look so great. And it just, that cycle just feeds and feeds and feeds. And suddenly, like, your things start going your way and the medicine, you're not feeling that sick from it.
And were you always like a positive person, or did when you got sick, did you realize, oh wow, well, I'm such a positive person? It kind of unlocked that in you, or
you know, I think one thing is I've been an entrepreneur for 20 odd years, and I'm working in large parts, at times on my own, at times I built up teams of people and so on. But you need positivity in that game because you get so many knocks. And, you know, I had days my business wasn't working well where I sat and I cried. I'd no very little money. What's interesting is being a software developer at that time, I probably could have gone and sent the CV out and gone for jobs, but I never did. I just said, go again. You know, and I reflected on that. I never threw in the towel. I'd always get back up, always. And I'd say, you know what, Kieran, feck this, I'm going again. I'm going again. And, you know, I'm like I just refuse to lie down. And even now, like, you know, I refuse to lie down. And in this, there's just no getting rid of me, you know. And you know, I just keep going and I keep going and I keep going. And I very much bring that. And look, I love laughing and I love life. I love people. I love my friends. I love getting out, sometimes maybe out too late if you found out down at 6 in the morning. But I just love life. I just enjoy it. I don't take myself too seriously, you know. And I think that has been immensely helpful. I didn't think that I'd use it in this sense. But I think the lessons of being kind of an entrepreneur and being on that lonely path at times really stood to me, because I was used to knockbacks and setbacks and just going at it again and going at it again. And ultimately, if you keep going, you start making progress sooner or later, you know. Well, at least I found I did.
So you started to get good news then. The chemotherapy was working.
So what happened then was that at the end of January, my consultant, to be fair to him, was very upfront and said, at the end of January, we'll have a kind of a debrief. There was no drip feeding of how well it was going, but I kind of got an indication. What happened was, after the infection, my blood started coming up. And when you see your blood started coming up, you can see an end in sight for that, in that first round. And so they came up very nicely. They were very happy with that progress. And so we sat down with the consultant and he said, the good news that you're in remission, you know. Now, at that point, that was fantastic to hear, because, you know, there was a chance that I may not have been in remission. And that's equally, it's funny, because leukemia, there's a very set way of treating it. So just because you're not in remission at that point doesn't mean, you know, you can on the next round you can go into remission, and okay, there's other paths of treating it and so on and so forth. So, you know, in my instance, I was in remission, which was a very positive thing. I'd responded well to treatment, and you know, ultimately I was out for a couple of days back home and back to Super Queen sausages and jam donuts and yeah, all the nice things.
What was it like to go home?
You know, it was amazing because I hadn't been home since, you know, the early start of January. And I think now it was, or since mid-January, should I say, and it was now March. I think that there were the dates. I thought I'd be more emotional, but I think I was just knackered and I just wanted to get lie down on the couch and just relax. And it was still all kind of new to me. I didn't really know what I'd been through. I had just got down the bottom of that water slide and I was just like, what the hell just happened there?
And you went in then for your transplant. Was that on your 40th birthday?
Yeah. So what happened was then I had a second round of treatment in the Mater Hospital, and that's standard again. So I went in, same as the first round, second round in the Mater.
In for another 35 days?
30 odd days.
Right,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So it was more or less the same. You have things like temperature spikes and the rigors, and there is, you know, to point out, various different ups and downs. It's not just you lie there and everything's fine, but again, we were very positive, and I think this time I knew what to expect from the first round, so yeah, it gave me a bit more comfort. Equally, it was funny because it brought with it a bit more, like when you get the chemo, you'd kind of know you were getting the chemo, and it would have, what do they call it? There's like where you get the nausea, anticipatory nausea, where you know you're going to get something, so you start feeling a little bit ill. The first time I didn't know what it was, and I took it fine. And the second time I kind of knew what was coming, and I suffered nausea a little bit more.
Wow.
And that was interesting because that was all mental.
Yeah.
And there was one day that springs to mind, and it was one of the rare occasions where Denise had just slipped off for an hour or two. There was nobody around. And up to that point, I'd been feeling fine. But this day, I just was feeling pretty down. And I lay in the bed. And I always made a point every day of not lying in the bed till 6 in the evening. Mm. I'd get up and I'd sit in a comfortable chair, but I wouldn't lie in the bed. But this day, I lay in the bed and I started getting upset because I was aware that transplant conversation was coming up at some stage, and you know, I didn't know anything about transplant. I was frightened, and my consultant came in, and you know, he was always very clinical, and we built up actually over time a great rapport, and we would have good conversations, but you know, and a bit of a laugh. But he was always clinical when it came to the medical side of things. But at that point, he saw I was a bit upset, and he pulled up the chair beside me and he said, "Karen, what's wrong with you?" And I broke down crying. And I said to him, "Look, you know, I'm frightened that, you know, I'm going to die." And he was very reassuring in his words. And he said to me, "Karen, you know, like, what are you doing lying on the bed?" And I said, "I feel unwell, Nat." And he said, "You know, why don't you get up on your bike to try to do 10 minutes? I brought in an exercise bike." and he left, and I got up on the bike. And the Mater Hospital is beautiful. On the top floor overlooks Glasnevin, which is where I'm from. And it was one of those scenes, and it was like a movie. And I got up on the bike, and I hit the first couple of strides, and I put on the iPhone, and I put on Born Slippy, you know, and it's a great, you know, intro, like a din, 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 you know, and I just started pedaling, and I started, the tears were flowing, and I started really pedaling, and really pedaling, and then I really started pedaling, and the music started going, and the fire just started burning inside me, and, you know, 10 minutes turned into 15 minutes turned into 20 minutes, and then I was off that bike and I was doing press-ups and sit-ups and everything.
Oh my God.
And I just really got Kieran, like, you know, this is it. Like, and you know, the funny thing about it is I could have gone out dancing around toward that after that. I felt fantastic. And that just says it all, you know, is that I was lying there one moment, you know, and feeling sorry for myself, and the next minute I was ready to get stuck in, and the positivity had returned, and all it took was you know, some kind words,
a nudge.
Mm.
It's,
yeah,
incredible.
Yeah, so it was It was a special moment, you know, because it definitely, at that moment, I needed it. You know?
And isn't it nice that you were alone when that happened, you know?
It was, because, you know, there's times when you kind of need those moments.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Yeah.
You know, like people can be there for you, but it is just you at times too, mm. you know, and like it is just you who has it, you know, whatever cross you're carrying, whether that's illness or anxieties or mental stress or whatever. And so there's a time when you need to get yourself over that and moment. And that was one of those moments when being on that bike, and, you know, it was fantastic feeling.
Next week on the Good Glow podcast.
Then I woke up one morning and just life was just different. I just had this sense come over me of just huge perspective, like you've touched on, and humility and gratitude. And I sat out in my back garden and I cried tears of joy. And I just felt amazing, and just operating, like I say to my pals, like the Matrix and that movie Limitless at the same time. Like, just a sense of awareness of the world around me and everybody around me, and love and hope and positivity, and it just flowing out of my body.
Thanks for listening to the Good Glow podcast, made possible by Fitbit. Fitbit wants you to be empowered by providing you with personalized data about your health so you can make positive changes to lead a healthier lifestyle. Life is about balance and action, not lots of distractions. Get to know yourself better and understand your health with Fitbit. I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, please rate and review, and follow me on Instagram at Georgie.Crawford.